want to continue doing what they're doing in Palestine with no consequences.
Professor, President Trump is about to become president again in just over 2 weeks. Do you expect U.S. policy towards Yemen to change?
I don't, because for the past 22 years, a U.S. president has been bombing Yemen, starting with the Bush administration, continuing on with Obama, who expanded the drone campaign and then launched the, you know, full support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen from 2015 to the end of his presidency. Then we had Trump, who just continued selling weapons to the Saudis and supporting their war every step of the way. Then President Biden said that he would end the war in Yemen, but really just continued supporting them, but just under a rebranding, essentially, as a defensive rather than an offensive war. And now Biden is directly bombing Yemen. And so I don't expect U.S. policy in Yemen to change. I expect Yemenis to continue doing what they can to defend themselves. But unfortunately, we've seen over the last 22 years that the U.S. will continue to break its own laws. It's unconstitutional to attack another country without congressional approval. And honestly, what is Congress doing while all of these presidents have been attacking? So unfortunately, I don't expect policy to change, but this should not be accepted. This should not be normalized. And we as citizens should be doing everything we can to stop it.
We have to leave it there. Professor Shireen Al-Adeimi, thank you so much for joining us. A happy birthday to Dennis McCormick and Clara Ibarra. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Mr. No, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With the help of our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute during our year-end campaign, you can still support KBOO by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give and join the team.
Ear to the streets. Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the streets.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 200 new temporary overnight shelter beds will open in Portland next week.
Portland City Council elects its first president and vice president.
And in national news, the Surgeon General recommends a new warning label for alcohol, which can cause cancer.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 3rd, 2025. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Josh Salem. 200 overnight shelter beds will be open in Portland next week, according to a new announcement from Mayor Keith Wilson and County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson. They'll be located at two Salvation Army buildings, one on Southwest 2nd and the other on North Williams Avenue. The shelters will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and they're first come, first serve. Folks who do sleep there one night are guaranteed a spot for the next night. The shelters are congregate, meaning people who go there to sleep will get a sleeping pad in a shared room. Light food and basic hygiene supplies will be available on site, as will social workers to help connect people to services. The downtown location will be open to female-identifying adults only, and both will be low barrier, meaning people can bring their pets and they aren't required to be sober. When the county declares a severe weather emergency, the shelters will convert to 24 hours. Expanding overnight shelter availability was a key campaign promise from Mayor Keith Wilson. He said, quote, 200 beds is a great first step, but it is not the only step. We will need to continue expanding capacity rapidly and aggressively to meet the need on the street, end quote. The county and city each pitched in $375,000 to support the shelters for 3 months.
Portland's new city council had its first official meeting on Thursday in the newly renovated council chambers. It took 10 rounds of voting for the council to reach a majority for the president of the council. Councilors Candace Avalos and Olivia Clark were deadlocked for a number of votes, 6-6. Then the councilors who had been supporting Clark shifted their support to District 2 councilor and former Oregon AFL-CIO legislative director Ilana Pirtle-Guinea. Avalos and Pirtle-Guinea then tied in 4 more rounds of voting. Eventually, District 4 councilor Mitch Green switched his vote to Pirtle-Guinea, making her the first president of the Portland City Council. Then the council considered the vice president position. District 3 councilor Tiffany Koyama Lane was the sole nominee, and she was voted in unanimously. The role of the vice president isn't fully defined in the charter, so it's likely that the council will decide some of the aspects of that role in the weeks to come. Also to come is more specifics on what power the council president will have. That includes whether the president should be able to appoint committee members and chairs. Councilor Samir Kanal has led a cohort of councilors worried about giving the president too much power. He's concerned that if the president has outsized authority over the council's agenda and committees, it could undermine the intent of the voters who passed the charter change amendment. The next official city council meeting will be Wednesday, January 8th.
The U.S. Surgeon General just proposed that alcoholic drinks should carry a label warning, saying that they can cause cancer. KBOO's Doug McVeigh reports.
On Friday, January 3rd, United States Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy released a new Surgeon General's Advisory on Alcohol and Cancer Risk. The Surgeon General's advisory notes that research shows alcohol consumption to be the third leading preventable cause of cancer in the United States after tobacco and obesity. Nearly 100,000 cancer cases in the U.S. alone in 2019 were related to alcohol consumption, and alcohol-related cancers claim the lives of about 20,000 people in the U.S. each year. And yet, less than half of U.S. adults are aware of the link between alcohol consumption and cancer. The Surgeon General's advisory includes recommendations to help reduce alcohol-related cancers and deaths, including updating the existing Surgeon General's warning label on alcoholic beverages to include cancer risk and reassessing guideline limits for alcohol consumption. A copy of the advisory, entitled Alcohol and Cancer Risk 2025, is available through the U.S. Surgeon General's website, surgeongeneral.gov. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm...
Evidence has increasingly been mounting about alcohol's ill effects on people's health. Consuming alcohol raises the risk of developing at least 7 types of cancer, including liver, breast, and throat tumors. Beer, wine, and liquor already carry warning labels saying pregnant women should not drink and that alcohol consumption can impair someone's ability to drive. But Dr. Vivek Murthy's proposal would go even further, additionally raising awareness about the risk for cancer. Murthy said, quote, "For individuals, be aware that cancer risk increases as you drink more alcohol. As you consider whether or how much to drink, keep in mind that less is better when it comes to cancer risk," end quote. Such a label would require rare approval from the United States Congress. But even with Murthy's statement and the new research that shows the dangers of drinking, it's unlikely Congress will act on it anytime soon. It's been almost 40 years since Congress approved the first government warning label on alcohol, and no updates have been made since. In fact, any effort to add a warning label, cancer warning label, to alcohol would face significant pushback from the powerful beverage industry, which spends almost $30 million every year lobbying Congress. Recently, the federal government decided not to change the existing dietary guidelines around alcohol. They recommend women have 1 drink or less per day, while men should stick to 2 or fewer.
Research shows most people charged with crimes in Oregon cannot afford a lawyer, increasing the risk of unnecessary jail time and unfair trials. Years of underfunding have left the state critically short in the number of public defenders needed to meet this demand. State lawmakers will likely be looking at the issue during the coming legislative session. Isabel Charlet reports.
Oregon's constitution guarantees a state-funded lawyer for those who can't afford one, but a massive shortage of public defenders makes this unachievable. According to the Oregon Justice Research Center, more than 90% of people charged with crimes in Oregon depend on a public defender. However, Oregon has less than a third of the public defense attorneys needed to handle all the cases. Currently, over 3,400 Oregonians charged with crimes have no lawyer. Executive Director Shannon Wilson at Public Defenders of Marion County says public defenders are so overwhelmed with cases, they can get burned out after a few years.
There's not enough attorneys to address that work unless you want to adopt the belief that 300 clients per one attorney is enough to get legal representation.
The Oregon Public Defense Commission estimates the state needs 500 more public defenders to meet its obligations. In 2023, lawmakers approved $96 million for attorney retention, recruitment, and pay equity with prosecutors. But the commission says it's not enough. The Oregon Criminal Justice Commission says recriminalizing low-level drug possession enacted this year will lead to nearly 2,300 additional convictions annually, disproportionately affecting people of color. Wilson says if you can't afford a lawyer, you'll likely get put on a waiting list, and the wait can be 5 months or more. Without a lawyer, some people end up spending needless time in jail and are less likely to have a fair trial. Most of Wilson's public defense clients face poverty, medical, or substance abuse challenges, and Wilson says stigma remains a significant barrier to fully funding Oregon's public defense system.
This is our community, and I feel like we all have a responsibility to take care of everyone, especially like the most vulnerable people that can't advocate for themselves.
Despite the barriers, Wilson is optimistic that Oregon legislatures are headed in the right direction. The Oregon Public Defense Commission recommends doubling the state's two-year public defense budget from nearly $600 million to $1.3 billion by 2030. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A week from today, 5,000 nurses are planning to walk off the job from Oregon Providence hospitals. It's an open-ended strike, meaning there isn't a set end date. Their union, the Oregon Nurses Association, announced the plans to strike earlier this week. They say they cannot come to an agreement with Providence after a week of intensive bargaining. The potential strike is also notable because some doctors and advanced practitioners will be striking with them, the first time this has happened in Oregon. All 8 Providence hospitals will be impacted by the strike. The company has posted hundreds of temporary positions offering $100 an hour for people willing to cross the nurses' picket line. In the strike announcement, the Nurses Association wrote, quote, "The corporatization of healthcare has left many Providence employees frustrated and burnt out as they are being told to spend less and less time with patients and more time trying to drive up profits," end quote. The union says they remain open to negotiating for the next week. It would call off the strike in exchange for movement from Providence.
The 119th Congress was sworn in today, including first-time Oregon Congresswoman Janelle Bynum from the 5th District. Representative Bynum is the first Black member of Congress in Oregon's history. Bynum said in a statement, quote, "As a mom in this community, I know that our families and businesses are ready for a leader who puts their needs first. Housing is unaffordable, health care is too hard to access, and our schools need support in producing the next generation of technical and intellectual leaders. These issues aren't exclusive to one party or the other. They affect all of us. That's why I will work with anyone to deliver for this district. The American people need our help, so let's get to work," end quote.
Federal officials present more information about the New Orleans terrorist attack and the Las Vegas Cybertruck explosion. Mike Johnson wins his House speakership battle. And Congress's latest budget stopgap leaves telehealth regulations relaxed. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
To all the families of those who are killed, to all those who are injured, to all the people of New Orleans who are grieving today, I want you to know I grieve with you. Our nation grieves with you. We're going to stand with you as you mourn and as you heal.
President Joe Biden says the Texas man who killed 15 people and injured 35 others in New Orleans worked alone. Shamsa Dinjabar was a veteran who drove a rented pickup flying an Islamic State flag into pedestrians on Bourbon Street. Although he was a citizen born in America, President-elect Donald Trump wrote on Truth Social that Dinjabar immigrated into the country over what Trump called Biden's open border. Meanwhile, a Tesla Cybertruck explosion outside Trump's Las Vegas hotel is being ruled a suicide. The driver was Green Beret Matthew Allen Livelsberger, who described by his uncle as a strong Trump supporter. Police found several guns and numerous fireworks in the car. The FBI says although both trucks were rented using the same app, they found no connection. Police also say there were at least two mass shootings at New Year's celebrations, one with multiple gunmen in New York City and another at an Illinois party. Officials looking to prevent shootings say they're worried the Federal Office of Gun Violence Prevention could be gutted by the incoming Trump administration, and Lindsay Nichols with the Giffords Law Center says gun restrictions at both the state and federal levels are at risk.
We know that these gun laws work, and there really is no reason why legislators shouldn't be taking action to prevent these tragedies.
The 119th Congress is scheduled to pick a Speaker of the House today. Despite an endorsement from Trump, Mike Johnson already has one, GOP lawmakers saying he'll vote against him. The majority is so narrow that might be enough to force another protracted leadership fight. Johnson told Fox News he has the votes and the right qualities.
What we need right now, I think my colleagues recognize this as well, is a proven fighter and a true MAGA conservative, but also someone who can work with every single member of our very diverse House GOP so that we can get President Trump's priorities over the line.
All Democrats say they'll be there to vote, although at least one Republican, Kay Granger of Texas, is likely to be too sick to attend. Some conservatives are floating the idea of making tech multi-billionaire and Trump ally Elon Musk the speaker. Biden awarded the Presidential Citizens Medal to 20 people today, including two members of the House January 6th committee. Trump says former Wyoming Republican Liz Cheney and Mississippi Democrat Benny Thompson should be jailed for their committee work. Part of Congress's most recent budget stopgap left in place COVID-era relaxed regulations on Medicare telehealth that can be helpful for those unable to access in-person care, but critics say they're worried about lower quality and lax privacy provisions. Brad Gibbons with the University of North Dakota Center for Rural Health says while its use has declined post-pandemic, it's still useful for remote areas.
People can not only stay in their own community and interact with a physician or another type of provider and not having to travel, they can actually, in many cases, do this right out of their home.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1947, U.S. congressional proceedings are televised for the first time. The quote of the day is from Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, born this day in 2003. She said, quote, "We can no longer let the people in power decide what is politically possible. We can no longer let the people in power decide what hope is. Hope is not passive. Hope is not blah, blah, blah. Hope is telling the truth. Hope is taking action. And hope always comes from the people."
Former President Jimmy Carter died last week, and Alaska Natives remember his impact on the state. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A series of remembrances for President Jimmy Carter begins Saturday in Georgia. Next Thursday, there will be a national day of mourning. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, there are also reflections about the president's lasting impacts on Alaska.
President Jimmy Carter was known in southeast Alaska as Nuhuwu. The Deshiton clan of Angoon gave him that name when it adopted him sometime in the late 1970s. The Thlinkit name belonged to Billy Jones, a 13-year-old who witnessed the bombardment of Angoon by the U.S. Navy in 1882. His account was the basis for an apology to the village the Navy Secretary made this past October, more than 140 years later. Rosita Worrell, president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, says President Carter took one of the first steps to heal the trauma.
He was the first president, actually, that listened to their story.
Angoon is on Admiralty Island, which in 1978, Carter turned into a national monument. Then in 1980, added more environmental safeguards through the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. ANILCA also doubled the size of Alaska's national parks and refuges and set aside more than 50 million acres as wilderness. For Alaska Natives, ANILCA added more protections for hunting and fishing, which Worrell says should have been stronger.
It's not perfect, but without it, we wouldn't have had the protections we have.
But Worrell says Carter's most important legacy was the example he set as a leader up until his death last month at the age of 100.
He cared for humanity, and he proved it by doing the work himself. That's a trait that we admire.
Worrell says Garfield George of the Deschutes will represent the Thlinkit at President Carter's memorial service in Washington, D.C. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Cross-border governing bodies are taking steps to address mining pollution coming from Canada. Eric Tigetoff has more.
Coal mining pollution in the Kootenai River has flowed to Montana for more than a century and impacted water quality hundreds of miles downstream. Selenium is the biggest concern. It can harm fish and other wildlife at high concentrations. Tribes in the region have been at the forefront of addressing the issue. The Salish and Kootenai tribes' Tom McDonald is among those leading efforts.
It's just elevated every year, and they keep expanding and getting bigger, and the problem keeps getting worse, and it keeps moving downstream. It's affected the water course in the Kootenai River for nearly 400 miles into Montana and Idaho and then back up into Canada.
The International Joint Commission settles boundary water differences between the U.S. and Canada. It has announced the formation of a governance body to address pollution in the Kootenai River. The body will set up a cleanup plan over the next 2 years. The governance body set up to address the issue is composed of 11 governments, including tribal governments, the state of Idaho and Montana, and the Canadian province of British Columbia. McDonald says this issue comes down to the regulatory responsibility of British Columbia.
If they were just enforcing the rules and regulations that they're supposed to be doing, I don't think we would even be here today. So they haven't been doing their job, and so it's really laying more eyes on it, putting more pressure on them to enforce their rules and regulations and their mitigation packages.
The Canadian company NWP Coal is proposing a new mine in the same watershed as the existing coal mines. The company claims its project won't increase selenium contamination, but doesn't address the current pollution issue. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In an era when commodities dominate the agricultural sector, more attention is being paid to the psychology of animal abuse at livestock auctions and slaughterhouses. Mike Moen speaks with an undercover investigator who captured footage of animal auctions.
Livestock auctions take place across North America, and how the animals are treated by those handling them is raising eyebrows. An undercover investigator with Strategies for Ethical and Environmental Development, Pete Paxton, recently gathered footage from more than a dozen auctions. Those who viewed it say it shows terrified, confused, and exhausted animals being handled harshly or outright abused. It also shows workers with seemingly no regard for their suffering. Workers face pressure under fast-paced environments, but watchdogs say upbringing and culture also play a role in their ability to not display empathy. Paxton agrees that morally questionable tactics become second nature.
For many of them, it's like, this animal just needs to move. Everyone's always done that.
Research has shown the slaughterhouse environment has notable psychological impacts on workers. For example, these individuals are 4 times more likely to be clinically depressed. And experts say the growing presence of industrial agriculture has helped to further distance these effects from the public's consciousness. Nebraska is among the top 5 states for cattle sales. In revealing how easily desensitization can happen, Paxton says it's also easy to see how workers carrying out the abuse are otherwise good people.
In general, I'm not, like, really scared of these people. I didn't find them to be violent, terrifying people.
Paxton, who opted to use an alias for this story, notes the people he met while working at livestock auctions come from this same wider community. That includes police and inspectors on site, complicating any desire to pursue charges even in places where animal abuse is routine. This is Mike Moen for Nebraska News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting from Jessica Scott Reed.
Farmers often struggle to transition to organic production because the process is long and complicated and it can be expensive. But a new program through the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service in Oregon, combined with other national support, is making the process easier than before. Isabel Charlet joins us once again.
New funding is making it easier than ever for Oregon farmers to become certified organic. To achieve certification, farmers must go 3 years without using synthetic additives such as fertilizers or pesticides. The USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service in Oregon has launched the Organic Transition Initiative to provide financial and technical support. Ben Bowl of Oregon Tilth notes this funding is especially valuable because the transition can be costly.
During that time, they have to be farming as organic farmers, but they are not able to access an organic crop premium.
Farmers can also get support through the initiative to develop organic systems for fertilization, building soil, and controlling weeds. Bowl explains this initiative is one of a three-part national USDA Organic Transition Initiative. This five-year program provides mentorship from experienced organic farmers, technical assistance, and an organic market development program. He says with the three programs, the combined $300 million investment in organic farming is historic.
Right now, is an amazing time to consider transitioning to organic in terms of all of the support that's available.
Erica Thompson runs a U-Pick blueberry farm outside Corvallis that has been in her family since 1993. Thompson is a little over a year into the three-year process. She says figuring out a new fertility program and disease management has been a challenge, along with understanding the application and documentation process. Thompson says working with the Organic Transition Initiative has been helpful.
Being part of it has really solved or like is in the process of solving all my questions and uncertainties.
Along with farmers, support is available for ranchers and forest landowners looking to go organic. Applications for the current round of funding are due January 17th. More information can be found at farmers.gov/organic. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Bamboo could help lock in carbon and slow down climate change. The fast-growing plant absorbs carbon quickly and can be used to manufacture flooring, furniture, and more. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Bamboo is not just for panda bears. These tall, fast-growing plants can be used to make everything from flooring and furniture to fabric and cutting boards. And some scientists say bamboo could also help reduce climate change. As bamboo grows, it quickly absorbs a lot of planet-warming carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Then if people use the bamboo to manufacture products like floors or furniture, that carbon stays locked in the products for a long time rather than returning to the atmosphere. Bamboo can grow well in a variety of different environments and in degraded soils or areas where it might be challenging to grow many other crops. And Project Drawdown, a climate research group, has suggested that bamboo could be grown on hundreds of millions of acres of degraded forest land around the world to help slow the pace of climate change. Some types of bamboo spread aggressively and can outcompete native species, prompting concerns about growing it in more places. But other bamboo species are less likely to become invasive, and many parts of the world have native bamboo species they could plant. So this versatile plant could help reduce global warming. Like Climate Connections? Subscribe to our free daily podcast. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now we go to Pearl Stark with The Point Puzzle, the weekly radio brain teaser produced at KPOV Bend. This week's puzzle features wordplay themed around the new year.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you what these things have in common. Santa, a sentence, and a cat. Well, the answer is claws. Santa Claus, a sentence has a clause, and a cat has claws. Our winner this week is Daryl McKeel, who listens to KYAQ in Newport, Oregon. We start 2025 this week, a quarter of a century down. In honor of that, I thought of things that come in fours. Using one common set of four things, start with one copy of each unique letter, add one additional letter, and you will have tough answer. What is the original set of four? So again, start with a set of four things, and take one copy of each unique letter, add an additional letter, rearrange, and you have tough answer. What is the original set of four? When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Happy New Year!
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of December 30th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 3rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Jasmine Moss, Doug McVeigh, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Pearl Stark, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220.